Let's pick it up where we left off last time, but I was just going to read up to where we were. I'm going to read from the New American Standard Version, Matthew chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. Now, the number of theories about Magi, a number of theories. Here's one. One is that they were leftover Jews that were taken out of Jerusalem, that they were there, or leftover Israelites that came from the foreign lands. One theory is that they came from Parthia, another country east there, and that they came in, that were ancient Israelites. There's another theory that they were Gentiles, you know, that they were just Gentiles that came from there, and that they were people who saw. Now, interesting, their wording, we want to come and see him. We're looking for the one that's king of the Jews. They didn't say our king. They didn't identify themselves as Jews or as Israelites. They didn't say, I want to come and see our king. They said, we're looking for the one who was born king of the Jews. We saw his star, and we wanted to come here. Then Herod, you know, heard about it. So in verse 3, when Herod heard that he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him, gathering together all the chief priests and scribes and the people, sort of like the Sanhedrin, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. Of course, they quoted, in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what the prophet wrote. And in verse 6, he quotes Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. So then you go in verse 7, then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time that star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search for this child, you know, search for the child. And when you have found him, report to me so that I too may come and worship him. Of course, Herod had no plans to worship him. He wanted to kill him. After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star, which they had, seemed to follow them in the east, and it went on before them. Now, the star they saw in the east, but they came west. They had to come west. And they came until they came and stood over the place. So that sort of seems to be supernatural and stood over the place. You know, stars are so far, you can't tell whether a star is standing over a place or not from where you are. It's so far out there. So this had to be, in my opinion, now it's my opinion, an angel. An angel that stood over there like a star and led them right to where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly and with great joy. Now, they rejoiced, the shepherds rejoiced. And after coming, now here we come into verse 11. This is where we left off last night. And after coming into the house where the child, you know, with Mary, his mother, and they fell on the ground and worshiped him. Then opening their treasures, they presented their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. M-Y-R-R-H. Now, the word treasures, notice the phrase, they opened their treasures. That Greek word is called theosaros. And if you were to read those words, the exact lettering from the Greek to the English, we would use the word, it's a thesaurus. You know what a thesaurus is? Thesaurus is a treasury of words. You buy a book and it has all kinds of words. So if you say, I want to look up a different word for go, and it'll say went, and so, you know, fly, go, it'll give you a whole bunch of this. I want to look up a different word for mitigate, and then it'll give a whole, I want to look up a different word for, ambulance or establishment, or it'll give you all these various words. It's wonderful if you do a lot of writing, you have a thesaurus. This is the Greek word, thesaurus. It meant the place in which goods or precious things are collected and laid up. So in a sense, it was not just the treasures. They said they opened their, it should be their thesaurus, they opened their treasure box. They had a box of their treasures here. And they pulled out of that box the gifts of gold. So they had gold, they had frankincense, and they had myrrh. Now notice the phrase house. They moved into the house. They didn't go to a stable. They didn't go to the manger. Remember, in Luke's gospel, they talked about he was born in a manger. But from the time he was born in the manger to this time, they had moved from that to a house. Now, whether it was their house, I don't know. Whether they rented a house, whether they moved, somebody invited them into a house. They were still in Bethlehem, and that's where he was born, and they went into the house. So they moved to a house. Now, we get an inclination from the use of the Greek word for child. Notice that word is in the Matthew 2, verse 11. And after coming into the house, they saw the child. Okay? That word is paiden. P-A-I-D-O-N. It doesn't mean infant. It means toddler. Now, the Greek word for infant is used in Luke chapter 1, verse 41 and 44, chapter 2, verse 12, and also verse 16. But here, it's used as a toddler. The Greek word in Luke was for an infant. Brephos means a little baby, either pre-born, before it's born, or right after it's born. You know, it's a little baby. It's an infant. By now, we have no idea how much time went by, but we know that the child was much older, and it was not called an infant in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11. Now let's look at the words gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Because these three gifts were presented, tradition has asserted that there were three wise men. How many? Because there were three gifts, therefore there must have been three wise men. It doesn't say how many wise men. It could have been 10, it could have been 3, it could have been 5, it could have been 7. But tradition has been that it was 3. Tertullian even went so far, that was one of the early church fathers, to assert that there were kings mentioned in chapter 60 and verse 3, where it says here, "Nations will come to your light and kings to the brightness of your rising." This is Isaiah 60 and verse 3. Therefore, he said, these three kings. So we have the old Christmas hymn, these three kings of Orient are, for the wise men, and they were considered three because they were three gifts. We have no statement in the Bible that it was three, okay? And there's no statement in the Bible that they were kings, okay? So these are traditions that have developed. In Isaiah 60 and verse 6, we read this, "A multitude of camels will cover you, and young camels from Midian and Ephath, all those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense and will bear good news of the praises of the Eternal, of Yahweh." Okay? They will bring good news of the praises of the Eternal. That's Isaiah 60 and verse 6. Very close parallel to what has happened. Now, frankincense was a luxury import. You know, look at it here, you don't think. It's made from the rosin of a tree which grew in Arabia. That tree grew sometimes in Arabia, in India, and Somalia. But they have to take the rosin, they have to take the bark of that tree, the rosin off it, and distill it, so to speak. Myrrh was also a rosin of a tree which grew in Arabia and Ethiopia. These rosins had a wide range of uses for ritual use, you know, for religious practices, and also in magical use, and also in wedding ceremonies, and for cosmetic purposes, and, you know, just as a spice to make you smell good. And also they were used medicinally for what the body could use, like one of the essential oils that you have. These are very good for you. In the Old Testament, we find that various pairs of these things, gold, frankincense, or myrrh, pairs too. You'll see some scriptures where the pairs gold and frankincense, some scriptures gold and myrrh, or some place scriptures frankincense and myrrh, but never all three in the Old Testament. Here you have in verse 11 all three of them mentioned, gold, frankincense, and myrrh all together. Let's take a look at a couple of scriptures. Here's Exodus chapter 30 and verses 23 and 34 mentions myrrh and frankincense. They are ingredients, among others, of the anointing oil and incense for the use at the tabernacle or the temple. The Song of Songs in chapter 3 and verse 6 refers to frankincense and myrrh, perfume for the room of Solomon. You know, it's going to perfume his room. In the Song of Songs in chapter 3 and verse 11 and also verse 13, gold and myrrh are mentioned as images of the attractiveness of a beloved. Now, your body's like gold, and you smell like myrrh, and so these are images of the attractiveness in the Song of Songs. I won't take time to read those scriptures, but I'll quote them for you. I'll refer you to them. So much effort has been spent to interpret the significance of these gifts, but we don't know definitely why these gifts were. Well, we do know they were expensive. We do know they were used for royalty, and it is possible that they were used in the fulfillment of Isaiah 49, verse 23, and Psalm 72. I'm going to read passage from Psalm 72, beginning in verse 8, Psalm 72. May he also rule from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. Let the nomads of the desert bow before him, and his enemies lick the dust. Let the kings of Tarshish and the islands bring presents, the kings of Sheba and the Sheba offer gifts, and let all kings bow down before him, all nations serve him, for he will deliver the needy from the cry, when he cries for help, and he will deliver the afflicted also, and him who has no helper. He will have compassion on the poor and the needy, and the lives of the needy he will save. So here are calls for the Messiah to be worshipped from various places all over. Okay, now let's go to Matthew chapter 2 and verse 12. And having been warned, now here after they presented their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, now having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. Now, I would say if they were Jews left over, they may want to stay there. I don't know. They were rich, evidently, and they had these precious gifts. Why didn't they want to stay if they were Israelites? Why didn't they want to stay in Israel? Why didn't they want to stay in Judah? I don't know. There's no sense here, but we'll see. Note that the close links between chapter 1 and verse 20, but when he considered, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. You remember in verse 20? And in chapter 2 and verse 13, you have God appearing. He sent an angel of the Lord, okay, to Joseph again. But notice that the Magi got warned also. The same method of warning Joseph came to the Magi. They were warned not to go back to Herod, okay? So here's Joseph in verse 13. Get up. When they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared. Literally, the Greek word is appears. Now, in the Bible, there is what is called a historical present. You talk about something in the past as though you use present verbs. In other words, he says to me, and you're talking about the thing in the past. He says to me, why don't you go here? And I said to him, blah, blah, blah. But you'll say, put it in the present. It's called a historical present. Matthew uses that a lot, but you will not find that in the New American Standard Translation. You have to look at the Greek to see that history that he's talking. It doesn't really matter. It's really an issue of the past. So when they had gone out, the angel of the Lord appears to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." So the Magi, not reporting to Herod, you know, you think, well, that's the solution. If the Magi just don't go, that'll stop Herod. No, that'll delay Herod, but it will not stop him searching for the child. Herod was a paranoid, terrible person. Josephus said of Herod, he was a man who was cruel to all alike and who easily gave way to anger, and he was contemptuous of justice. He could care less if it was a just thing. So chapter 2, verse 14, so Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night. I mean, he got out of there. That angel must have really scared him, and he left for Egypt. Now notice that all these, you notice how Joseph is rising in prominence here? The angel is not talking to Mary and telling Mary to talk to Joseph. The dreams are coming to Joseph. And Joseph is hearing from the angel of God. And Joseph is now the man of the hour, so to speak. Joseph says, "Let's go. I'm taking my wife and this little boy, and we're going out of here. We're going." So in verse 14, you see, Joseph got up and took the child and his mother. Now in verse 15, he remained there in Egypt until the death of Herod. And this was to fulfill, what had been spoken by the Lord through his prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Okay? This was a quotation from Hosea, you know. And so this was to fulfill that. So right away, Matthew is now showing Old Testament fulfillment, because Matthew's gospel was written for Jewish, you know, for the Jews, to help convert Jews into Christianity. So I called my son. Now verse, Matthew setting up this analogy, notice, between Jesus and Israel. You'll see it. Because the original statement, "I called my son out of Egypt," was not talking about Jesus. The original statement there was talking about Israel. Israel was God's son, and he brought them out of the land of Egypt. In fact, what is the first statement in the Ten Commandments? You know, in Exodus 20, "I am the eternal your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." That's one of the characteristics of him. He brought them out of the land of Egypt. So now in Isaiah 40, verses 3 and 4, we see this. A voice is calling, "Clear the way for the Eternal in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up and every mountain and hill be made low, and let the rough ground become a plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley." In Hosea chapter 2, we see these scriptures in verse 14. "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her. Then I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt." You see, God brought his people as a group and refers to them like it was a her, like his wife. Out of the land of Egypt. And Matthew is making an analogy between Jesus and Israel in the Old Testament in Egypt. In verse 16, we read this now. "Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged. And he sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and its vicinity from 2 years old." He wasn't taking any chances. How old was this kid? You know, from 2 years old all the way down to and under. Anybody, any male. "According to the time which he had determined from the Magi. You know, when did you see this? When did you do that? So they can't. So it's got 2 years would be the limit. The child can't be older than two, but you know, he could be all the way down. It could be 6 months. It could be 8 months. It could be, you know. And we know that he was not an infant when the Magi saw him. Now, research. Many scholars have researched this because it's a very touchy verse, brethren. A very touchy verse here in verse 16. Herod is now slow. He killed all the male children in Bethlehem and around. But based on the population of Bethlehem, which was a very small town at that time, scholars make an estimate of the number of children who were killed. And their best estimate never goes above 20, with several scholars saying it was much lower than 20 children. So never above 20, and many thinking it was, you know, 8, 10, 12 children that were killed. Nevertheless, that was horrendous. You come down and you kill 10, 12 children because you're afraid one of them might be this king of the Jews? So it fits well with Herod. Herod's victims, and you have the history of Herod, Herod's victims included not only the people who preceded him in government, anybody who was before him, they go after that person, you know, not like in the United States, one president leaves, another president comes in, but he doesn't go after that president to kill him, I'm going to murder him. No, we don't have such a thing here. But in ancient times, Herod would kill his predecessors. And he killed a large number of their supporters. If anybody supported the former king, Herod killed them. He also killed his own relatives, people directly related to him by marriage. He killed his brother-in-law, we know. He killed his mother-in-law. He even killed his favorite wife, whose name was Miriam. Later, his three oldest sons were eliminated. He was so paranoid, such a crazy guy, the thinking, I got all this power, maybe they're going to take it, maybe one of my sons is going to take it. He got rid of them. Herod also eliminated piecemeal one suspect after another. You know, sometimes he killed people wholesale, and sometimes he did it piecemeal one after another. There are four incidents recorded where Herod executed large groups of people that he suspected were against him. And he killed not only that group of people, but all their family members. So most commentators, you look about, you want to get a comment on verse 16 that Herod, you know, was enraged and he slew all these kids. Commentators back away from much of a comment. And the reason is, possibly, I don't know, you know, nobody knows the reason. But I'm going to make a guess. I'm going to make a guess that they don't want to comment because they could possibly make God look like he didn't care about the other male children. Herod was going to come and kill all the other. But God did not warn their parents, get these kids out of here, move to someplace else. Only Joseph got that. And these other kids were allowed to stay there, and they were killed. You know, once again, Matthew is drawing a sort of a comparison here. Who was saved while other male children were killed in the past? That was Moses. Moses was saved through his mother sending that little basket down the Nile, and where she knew that that Pharaoh's daughter was, and that Moses was such a cute kid that they would just immediately take him. She nursed him for a while, but you know, and she couldn't keep him in the house without people knowing. Because he got older, and then he's going to make noise and so on if he cries. So they had to get rid of him, and I hope that Pharaoh's daughter will save him. And that's exactly what happened. So people don't touch verse 16. But God allowed the other children to be killed during Moses' time, and Moses saved. And I don't think, you know, you say, well, why would God let this happen? Why would God allow this? I've had people say something like this, well, God won't allow that, will he? God won't allow that. I have to ask this question. I answer it with this question. What is it that God won't allow? Do you know that right now, somewhere in the world, somebody is getting killed? Somebody is being tortured? Somebody is being raped? Somebody is being, executed? Little children are being molested. There are little children who are being killed. Do you know right now in the world there is that? Is God allowing it? He's not permitting it. He's not permitting it, but he allows it. What won't God let happen? God doesn't just stop everybody from doing every evil that there is. There's evil. And that's why we have a thing called in the Bible, the wrath of God is going to be meted out against all ungodliness. The day will come, that day of the Lord, when all this will be done and they will pay for these evils. That's what I believe. That's what the Bible teaches. Now we drop down to verse 17. Then we see this statement. Then what was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And now they quote Jeremiah 31, verse 15. A voice was heard in Ramah. Where is Ramah? Ramah is north of Jerusalem, about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. A voice was heard in Ramah weeping. Now, Ramah is the opposite way from Jerusalem. Bethlehem is south of Jerusalem, and Ramah is north of Jerusalem. So it's a voice heard in Ramah weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Now that quotation is from Jeremiah. Ramah in verse 18 is a quote from, as I said, Jeremiah 3 in verse 15, but it relates to Genesis 48 in verse 7. Rachel was the mother of both Joseph and Benjamin. Now, you know about the city of Ramah, which was the gathering point where Sihon of Assyria, when he was taking the northern tribes, he gathered them there at Ramah. And that was like the launching point, would bring them all down to this place in Ramah and we'll go from there. It was 6 miles north of Jerusalem. It's the collecting place for the northern 10 tribes. Now, Rachel had 2 children. She had Joseph and she had Benjamin. Joseph was part of the northern tribes. Her children split apart. Benjamin's part of the southern tribes. When they took the tribes north, Jeremiah says Rachel has to be symbolically there. You know, Rachel was dead. She was buried in Bethlehem. Rachel was weeping, sort of symbolically, for her children who were being separated. The northern tribes being taken into captivity by Sihon, the Assyrians, and the southern tribes staying down in Judah. They later were taken captive by, as we know, by Nebuchadnezzar. So she was symbolically weeping for her lost children. But Matthew applies that here to these kids that were being killed, this verse. Matthew now, chapter 2, verse 19. When Herod died, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother and go back to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child are now dead. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother and came back to the land of Israel in verse 20-21. Okay. Verse 22. Archelaus, when he heard that Archelaus was the king reigning in Judea in place of Herod, Herod being the Herod the Great, he was afraid. Now, Archelaus also had a terrible reputation. You know, he was not a good guy, and he just, let's get out of here. He was afraid, and then he was warned by God in a dream. Again, listen to Joseph. How many dreams did Joseph have? He was warned by God in a dream in verse 22, and he left the regions, you know. He left here for the regions of Galilee. Okay, and verse 23. So Joseph, he continues to be this this Jacob and this Israel. He comes front and center. Joseph, who is Jesus' legal father, is now shaped into the patriarch of Joseph by Matthew. Now he's telling you all this. He's comparing Joseph here to the Joseph of the one who rescued the people out of Egypt. You remember Joseph, the guy who had all these dreams, an interpreter of dreams? So this Joseph now says, I'm getting out of here. He's warned to take the child north because Archelaus is just as bad as his father. And he came and lived in a city called Nazareth. Okay? So, and you see also Moses' story coming forth. You know, that Moses was saved, you know, among the children of there, and also Moses was the one who was warned and was talked to by God and so on. So you see Moses' narrative coming in here. This was so the Jews would see these very similar stories. Okay, now Nazareth was a very small place. Okay. And it was a very small town. It had been there for a long time, but it's hardly ever mentioned. I don't think it's mentioned once in the Old Testament. But you have something, you know, he shall be called a Nazarene. Where you get that quote exactly? I don't know, but here you have two prophets. There were two prophets who were Nazarites, both of whose mothers did miraculous, got special knowledge through an angel of the Lord and bore them when sometimes they were barren. These two prophets were Samson, he was a Nazarite, and Samuel. Both of whom had miraculous births, specific births planned and announced by God. Now, Matthew uses five citations from the Old Testament. Okay? The first one, and this is chapter 1 and 2 now combined, the virgin will conceive. You remember Isaiah, virgin will conceive? Then the second one was the quote about Bethlehem, where is the child coming? Well, it's Bethlehem of Judea. The third quote was the suffering children of Rachel mourning for her children. The fourth quote was the coming back of God from Egypt, of God's son from out of Egypt. And the fifth quote was going to Nazareth. He was like that. This would be called a Nazarene from the prophets through what was spoken through the prophets. Now, we don't have an exact quote, but we have what was spoken through the prophets and probably the prophets like Samuel and Samson. Now, there is a play on words here in a combination of spellings, and I won't go through the technology of this. It's just too much to deal with because none of us knows the Hebrew and the Greek as well as some of these scholars. But there's a play on words, the combination of spellings in the Greek and a related word in the Hebrew, and you come up with two words that could possibly be translated exhumed, you might say, from the word Nazareth, okay, taken out of the word Nazareth. They are branch and holy. And this leads you to Isaiah chapter 11. Verse 1, then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And he will, you know, and we know that Jesus Christ was holy. His things, it was holy, set apart. It's holy, set apart, sanctified. And we see this, and whether that is what the meaning of Nazareth finally meant, we don't know. But it's very possible. Now, Nazareth was a very small town, south, you know, and west of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus grew up there, not very far from another town, which you don't see in your on the maps of your Bible, called Sepphoris, which was this town where there was a lot of building and there were a lot of theaters going there. And Jesus and his father, he worked with, I say, his, ostensibly his legal father, Joseph, may have gone there for as a carpenter and building theaters. And Jesus seemed to talk about actors a lot, hypocrites. They were actors. The word hypocrite meant actor. You're a pretender. You're pretending you're something you're not. And Jesus saw that, evidently, if he went to Sepphoris, and there's a good chance that he did. So by the time Matthew's readers, you know, the readers of Matthew's gospel, read chapters 1 and 2, they are giving a whole Old Testament background from the law and the prophets. This is in preparation for Jesus Christ's public appearance, you know, as the Messiah, as the Messiah from the house of David, as the unique Son of God, who will come into Galilee to be baptized by the Baptist. Now, in along with the analogy of Moses and Israel coming out of Egypt, where does Jesus go shortly after he is baptized? In chapter 4, we see what it says. And Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness. Into the wilderness, where the wild animals and all this stuff, and where the Satan comes then to tempt him. So the very analogy, Matthew is making a lot of analogies here that Jewish people could read. We're reading it. And I hope you've gotten something out of Matthew chapter 1 and chapter 2. The birth and survival of this little boy who, as John says, and the Word was made flesh, and he dwelt among us. And he was saved from the destruction by the worldly empires and the worldly kings. This world's nations are not God's, that's for sure.